You're sort of famous as being the chronicler of the difficult lives of Chinese American mothers and daughters. You've done this through four novels that have been very successful, from The Joy Luck Club to The Bonesetter's Daughter. And now all of a sudden you've taken a huge jump. It's almost as if you've jumped ship with the Saving Fish from Drowning. You've got a little bit of that in there, but you're really doing a much larger, much more comical take on Americans of different sorts traveling in Asia. Were you just tired of mothers and daughters?
No, not at all. In fact, you know, there's actually, in spite of what seems to be a huge difference in what I've written in the past, a continuation, in to my mind. The narrator of the story is actually the voice of my mother, meaning it's based on her voice, her sense of things, the way she would tell a story. So to me, it's still very much about the kinds of things I've always written about, but it's a different way of expressing it. This particular woman is dead, the narrator. And in part, that was fueled by what had happened at the time that I was starting the story, which is that my mother had died. And I was very sad that she wouldn't be there to inspire or sort of serve as my muse for my stories. But it was as if she said, well, I can still be in the story. I don't have to be a mother. I can tell the story. And I realized that was true. And so she is the voice of the narrator. When I say that she's the voice and she's part of the continuation of everything that I've written, it's not simply the way she tells these things. My mother had a particular way of looking at the world, and as much as anything, I was writing about that in my earlier books, the differences between how she and I believed in different things, but also saw through these differences with a mutual heart. My mother believed in fate. She believed in bad luck. She believed in not listening to your mother as being the source of many bad things that happened to you, and she believed she could undo fate. She believed in all the possibilities, and this is a narrator who also does. She just takes us into the larger world to look at that.
Although she seems like a much more extravagant person than the mothers in your earlier novels.
She's cranky. She's biased. She's opinionated, she's feisty, she's a little arrogant at times, and my mother was all of those things. My mother was more than all the characters I've ever written about, including Bibi Chen in this latest book, but my mother was the same kind of things that are in this character, and you know, the parts of her that I did love. She was a kind of a snob from Shanghai, and she was very critical. She'd point out people's flaws and kind of read into what people were really thinking and why they did something. And so, yeah, she's definitely there.
I had two other thoughts as I was reading the book. One, I had read your essay about your love affair with Nabokov.
Uh-huh.
And it struck me that perhaps because the narrator in this case was dead and much more free-floating, you could take up let yourself go a bit in his direction with a little more wordplay, although there's wordplay in all of your novels, but a little more extravagant and a little more arrogance and a little more just of that more worldly attitude.
Well, thank you for the the even partially close comparison of ever approaching anything that Nabokov did. With language. Yes, I'm a huge admirer of what he wrote and the intelligence behind every single word and even punctuation that he had in his books. I did have a good time, you know, playing with the language, but and I also think that what I was writing about was not really poking fun at American tourists, because they do think that what I had written could apply to anybody in any country, going into the country that they're not really certain about, they're not really clear on whatever the situation is overall politically or even culturally. And so there's bound to be a kind of misperception and comedy of errors that you often see. But in a story, of course, we magnify them and keep them playing off of one another.
But these people are so well-intentioned, but they each have their blind spots, and in spite of their well-intentions, they each make horrible faux pas.
They each have their secret desires, too, and I think they often fuel what our intentions are. They make some cultural gaffes, but I think what predominates is their sense of heart in approaching a very difficult situation with other people who are suffering and not knowing quite what to do and being caught into it themselves and having the need to save their own skins. I have felt that in various ways myself, and I think that we all run into situations where people are suffering and we're thinking, well, what should we do? When you pass a homeless person, you know, that idea, well, I can't save the world, or I feel terrible about this person, I'm going to go work at a soup kitchen, or I'm going to give money to an organization that helps to create jobs, or I'll give a dollar to this person today, or I'll say hi and treat them like a real human being. Or it runs the gamut of how we respond to the suffering of other people. And then not knowing what of our actions or inaction will leave as a consequence. If the consequence is actually not a good one, what is it that we follow up on at all? Do we have a moral response and a feeling, well, even though my intentions were good and this terrible outcome happened, should I feel responsible? It's such a quagmire for me to think about that I just knew I had to write about it, because whenever something really troubles me, then I think, well, there's a good point for a novel. You know, I need to figure it out in the longhand form.
Was it your own travels to Myanmar that had led to this, or?
I was invited, and at first I thought, like the characters in the book, the things had improved there. You know, I also had to stop and say, Myanmar, where is that? Oh, Burma. Yeah, I remember Burma. And then I started reading about it, and I thought, oh, well, things are worse than ever. And the woman who won the Nobel Peace Prize, Aung San Suu Kyi, she's still under house arrest. And then I had, you know, read that people are not supposed to go there to show their protest of the military regime that took over. But then I thought to myself, well, should I feel good about this? Should I pat myself in the back and say I really help people when I'm just going to go on vacation somewhere else? And, you know, and I just get myself into these moral labyrinths that go round and round and round. And I figured that I should really think about this and ask more questions. Apart from that, though, this is a question that has come up to me over and over again, because starting with the time that I was published, people would say to me, say things to me like, well, you should go over to China and stand in Tiananmen Square and protest what the government is doing there. And at first I thought, well, yeah, I should do that. But later I realized that, would that really serve any purpose? Would that really make things better for people over there? And I also knew that if I did that, I would make things very difficult for my family who lived there. Would I then suffer those consequences? No. Would I feel responsible to my family if they were punished? I should. So I really had to think about why I would do something like that in the name of helping people and be aware of what could possibly happen and whether or not I truly would be helping people or not. So with all of this, I'm just saying that there is really no right answer. I mean, it's such an individual thing, but I had to ask myself all the questions and play through from the very difficult and heartfelt to the kind of ridiculous, which includes some of the reasons that I think about things.
Yeah. In your earlier novels, the moral problems are quite knotty, and the questions of loyalty and independence and all the things that go on within families and between cultures. Here, the touch is much lighter, and probably because Bibi Chen it's seen through her eyes.
Yeah.
And it's much more comic. And at a certain point, I also had the impression, you know, this is almost like a Dave Barry novel.
Yeah.
And I know that he's one of the people you sometimes hang out and make music with.
Uh-huh.
Any sense to that?
Well, I had not thought about that, but maybe there is some aspect that's rubbed off on me about Dave Barry. I actually think now that the kind of I don't know, the kind of humor or the kind of interest in looking at what's ludicrous has always been there for me. And I actually thought that my earlier books were more funny than perhaps people thought they might be. They were, you know, I always got this comment that the books were poignant mother-daughter tales, you know, and for the men, tearjerkers or something. But to me, there was as much that was funny in the books as I was writing it for myself, as there were things that were painful and difficult and, in a way, transformative for me as I was unlocking doors to the past and confronting those issues again.
I was thinking that maybe it was easier for there to be a light touch here because Bibi Chen is childless, and she sort of looks upon the people who take the trip as, well, she calls them my friends all the time, but she's looking at them in a very maternal way, but very distant.
Yeah, yeah. She's without a mother and without a child. She really doesn't belong to anyone in one sense. My mother was somebody who always regretted that she had lost her mother when she was very young and felt she wasn't feeling as deeply as most people would be able to if they had a mother, and that some of the mistakes in her life or the inadequacies had to do with the loss of the mother. And so Bibi Chen has that as well. And she has no children, and yet she begins to feel what I think many of us feel when we do have kids or when we are caught in a situation where we have to somehow be the ones responsible for the care of others. And I think there's a sense of what her responsibilities are and her desires also to make people see things in a certain way, which is, of course, what my mother also did with me.
It's kind of funny to me that in your earlier books, which other people see as rather tense moral dramas, you see a lot of humor. And in this book where I see a lot of humor, you're seeing pretty stark moral choices.
I see a number of things that in my books that are not one or the other. They're always a combination of both, and I often think that the most painful things, the most serious things, sometimes require humor to make them become, almost palatable to even think about, to look at it without some kind of moral seriousness that somehow dictates what the conclusion is before you've even started to look at what the issues are.
Boy, I'm getting... So you had decided... I think when I look at this book, I think that the characters are all people with conflicts, but there's no clear resolution.
Yeah.
So you hadn't really ended with a... You didn't start with a resolution in mind.
No, I didn't want one. In fact, with all of my books or anything that I believe or in any situation, I think what people might consider fence-sitting is for me this absolute imperative in my life not to come to any definitive conclusions on what I see as an absolute truth on what you should do or how things are. To me, the stories are never finished, and if you were to turn to another page, it would continue and another complication would happen. And that's pretty much how I feel about a lot of things in life. There is no one way that we should think about these things or that it can be right or wrong. So that, you know, if anything, I suppose I always knew that I wouldn't have some sort of resolution for anybody or some easy answer. With each of those characters at the very end, there's something open-ended about all of them.
I think it's kind of funny that I could see, from having read some of your autobiographical essays, I could see in earlier books how certain characters were based on experiences from your family life. And in this case, where the death of the mother is similar, you had already related, I could see that, but I thought you were really trying to get away from your family and just throwing in a few incidents. But you say that in some ways this is the closest to your mother.
It is, by taking her point of view, it's an enormously wide point of view, and applying it to the outside world. I could take that voice and go anywhere in the world and apply it to a moral situation, and I would find a lot of humor and a lot of contradictions, and just it would open my observations up in so many different ways, because my mother did not believe in one consistent philosophy. She believed in all of it. She could believe in miracles. She could believe in DNA and medical breakthroughs. She could believe in fate and bad luck and curses and all of that, which is a wonderful canvas then for a fiction writer, because in telling a story, you have to say what happened and why to some degree. And when you have a character who believes that what happened and why is all over the place, you know, it to me makes for a very unpredictable story with all kinds of surprises for me, the writer, as I'm writing it.
Remembering the mothers in some of the earlier books, and it sounds like we're going to talk about mothers an awful lot, like especially Joy Luck Club or Bonesetter's Daughter, I was quite surprised when I read your essay about what happened after your brother and father died, that your mother had basically picked you up and taken you to Europe, to Holland and then to Switzerland.
Yes.
And I could not have imagined the mothers from those two books having done that. But I could easily imagine B.B. Chen doing it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you know, people think, well, you know, this mother is nothing like your mother as they were in the other books, but I want to say, no, that feistiness of B.B. was definitely my mother. I am kind of, I'm older than my mother was at the time that my father and brother died, but I ask myself sometimes, if I had been in her shoes, if I had a husband and a son who just died, and I had these two surly, unhappy, angry teenagers, would I just chuck it all in and take them off to a foreign country where I couldn't speak the language and had no idea where I would live or where they'd go to school? I look back and I think my mother was both very, very brave, and she was also insane.
Well, enough about your mother. It's been almost 20 minutes talking. Have you sort of exercised? Well, here I'm coming right back to her. Have you exercised her? Is she going to appear in your future work?
Oh, no, she's always around. You know, I mean, who I am as a writer is so much informed by my mother and who she was and the kind of questions she forced me to think about. I think some part of her will always be in my books.
What are you working on now, though? Have you moved to a new topic, or are you just sort of taking time off?
Well, I'm working on a number of different things. I mean, just in terms of projects, I'm working on an opera. I'm writing libretto for an opera based on The Bonesetter's Daughter. I'm also working on an article for National Geographic. I am based on a village I just visited in China.
What village?
It's a village in southwestern Guizhou, which is nothing, a village no one's ever heard of. It's a tiny little village of about 1,300 people. And about a fifth of the homes there burned down recently. So I went there and stayed there for 12 days. I just got back, as a matter of fact, just the other day.
Was it the Geographic that said you should go there, or did you want to?
They asked me to write a story, and I thought, oh, I don't have time to do that. But then all of a sudden I remember this village I'd gone to for 2 days, and I'd always wanted to go back. And I said, hey, how about if I write about this village? And they said, great. It's for a special China issue they're doing. It's all about China. So every story is about China. And so this is their one about, this issue is about transformation. And this is about a village that will, like all of China, go through transformation. I'm also going to be working on a TV series and then a new novel. And the novel will, again, have some qualities of my mother's voice. And it wouldn't be surprised if it took place in that little village in Guizhou.
I think it was in the Joy Luck Club that the mother figure there said, when you go to China, you'll find out that you really are Chinese. Did that happen?
Well, my mother said it both ways. She said, as soon as your feet touch China, you'll be Chinese. And she also said, when you get, you know, when I was worried, I'd get there and everybody would say, oh, you belong here, and they wouldn't let me to come back. This is, you know, 20 years ago. My mother just said, oh, the minute you open the your mouth, they know you're not Chinese. You don't belong there. The minute you walk, they know, you're not Chinese at all. So she said it both ways. And I do feel exactly that. My mother was right. There are times that I'm in China and I feel this is a country I really belong to. My family history and what shaped me belongs here. And the other is I'm there and I stick out so much as somebody who clearly does not belong. I had to take a translator with me to the little village in order to speak to people who have a very thick accent of their tribe. But after a week, I found that I could understand pretty much everything they were saying. It just depends on the context, and after a while I become more this and less that, and it's never one thing more than the other forever. It's always in transition for me. I like to think of myself as always being in transition, you know, transforming and becoming something over the years, never one thing.